This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on January 7th, 2016. On this week's episode, Tia Vassiliou, Paul Jaisley, Kate Scotchless, and Nick White join me, Mike Rappin, for what I call the Great Debate. The topic of whether or not we should reimagine comics is the focus, and the argument was split into two sides, Tia and Kate versus Nick and Paul. After you finish the episode, we'd love to hear what you think about the topic. And now, this week's episode. This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. This is one of our most intense, insane episode ideas that we've ever had on this show. And I only say that because I want to build it up in my head to be something great. This week is what we are calling the Great Debate. And with me are four fantastic human beings. Tia Vassiliou.
Hi, I have a cold.
Paul Jaisley.
Hello, I also have a cold.
Nick White.
Hey, currently not ill, inevitably awaiting such.
And Kate Scotchless.
Hello.
Thank you all for joining me this week. This is something that I've been very excited for many, many weeks since a Twitter debate started a very big, long, epic adventure in my head. And now we're here recording this episode. So how have comic books been? How have all of you been? There's so many people on this show, so let's not try to scream and yell over each other. Kate, how are you?
I'm good. I am really surprised and pleased with how this all turned out from a random side comment I made on episode number, I don't remember.
52, I think.
Yeah. And then it just kind of blew up. So this is pretty exciting for me.
That's awesome. What did you read this week? What are you excited for?
What
did you read? Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's cool. This week I was really excited that Code Prue number 2 came out, and I can't pitch this thing enough. It is so cool.
What is this book? I've never heard of this.
It is a Garth Ellis, or yeah, his name.
Garth Ennis?
Ennis. There we go. That's what I was going for. Book, and so it is weird and crazy, and the art is so, it's all black and white ink. It is super intricate, and it's about, it's urban fantasy magic with elder gods and teenagers, and is as crazy and deranged as you would expect from Ennis.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
If he's going into the teenager route, I can only be scared. Because his books are typically really dark and nasty, and now there's teenagers involved, I can't imagine.
It's Cthulhu meets Superbad. Oh, shit.
That's basically, yeah. It's pretty awesome right now. So kids don't know what they're messing with these days.
Yeah. Nick, how are you? How have comic books been? What have you been reading? All that jazz.
Great. I would say the number one thing I was pretty much very pleased to read this week was Bloodshot Reborn number 10. I know you read it as well.
I did.
At my behest, when I IM'd you at a unusually, or actually pretty usual for us, late hour, and was like, hey, read this book. And you're like, well, you know, I'm actually doing other things because, my life, it exists and it goes on without you. I'll buy it tomorrow, damn it. And then I go to bed. Really, really great book. Again, Valiant needs to knock off this whole, every arc is a new great jumping on point. No, it's not. It's just not true every time. Honest to God, sometimes it's not. But this time, it is a very good jumping on point. It's a flash forward 30 years from where the book has been, so everything's very well removed from current canon and whatnot. And it is basically Mad Max in the sense that it's, you know, post-apocalyptic, everyone's fighting for fuel, everyone's fighting for water, everyone's fighting to kill each other for any sort of wanton reason. And on top of that, it's basically also Old Man Logan, because it's a universe, and Old Man Logan, it was obviously the Marvel universe, and in Bloodshot Reborn, it's the Valiant universe, which has basically transplanted all of the different characters and concepts and ideas and powers and some of the old storylines, and just dumped them into the post-apocalyptic wasteland to see how things play out. It's really, really fun. The art by Louis LaRosa is fantastic and very, very different from what we're used to seeing. I strongly suspect he probably banked a bunch of the issues in advance, not unlike what J.H. Williams III does, because he just can't draw at a normal monthly rate. But it's wonderful, and I eagerly await to see if they even try to rope this into the 4K universe this summer.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'll just jump right in here because I read this book as well. Nick and I have this back and forth thing now, which it happened twice, so now it's an ongoing thing, I guess. I basically Marvel comics. So Nick and I had this thing where I told him to read X-Men, the worst X-Men ever, and if he didn't like it, I'd buy him another comic. And so far, he hasn't told me that it was that bad, so, you know, I guess that was good. And so Nick did this exact same thing for me with Bloodshot Reborn. He said, this is a perfect jumping on point. And despite Nick telling me so much about, like, this book and how great it is, I really didn't have any idea what the book was about in terms of, like, actual story. So I jumped into it, and it was straight up Mad Max, and the moment all of the... this one moment happens that is very Mad Maxian, I guess, in a way. I was immediately sold on the book, as well as some of the very interesting pieces of Valiant Universe knowledge that I already had tying into this story. So I'm at least going to see through this arc. And if it ties into 4001, the big story event that's going to be happening this summer, then I'll be even more roped in because I plan on getting sucked into that guy. So, you know, it was good. But yeah, anyways, Paul, what have you been reading?
Well, probably the book that was the biggest surprise for me, or the most pleasant surprise, was Gotham Academy number 14. This is the new sort of mini story arc they're doing called Yearbook, where the two main characters from Gotham Academy are sort of reliving old stories. So it's like a way to spotlight the different characters in the ensemble cast of the book. But they're getting different creators to do each little story. So issue 14, there's like a story written and drawn by Katie Cook. There's a story drawn by Dustin Nguyen. There's a little story written by, Hope Larson. So you get like three different creative teams telling different stories about different characters. It's a nice way to, I think, recenter the book. I think that as much as I've enjoyed Gotham Academy, it's gotten kind of too bogged down in like one big storyline for a book that is an ensemble sort of cast. So if they're going to take four issues to focus on different characters, maybe focus on characters we maybe haven't seen yet a ton in the book, and also a way to get different creative teams on there, it's a very fun, cute read, and it's a way to get more bang for your buck in a way, since you're getting like four different creative teams in one book.
It must be really nice to actually have rotating artists at a big two book, and it's not because of meeting deadlines.
Right, yeah. It actually, like, it makes sense. Like, oh, like, let's tell a story about this particular character, but it's drawn in this way because it takes place this far in the past. Like, it makes sense, the overarching story of the book, but it's a nice sort of breath of fresh air before they gear up for the next big story arc. So I'm very surprised this book hasn't been as much of a critical or commercial success as, like, Batwoman or Squirrel Girl or anything like that. I think it's a very similar vein of those books, so highly recommend checking it out if you haven't yet.
Very cool.
I definitely think some of the lack of success is the way that it's pitched and promoted is very much as a Batman book for children.
Sure, yeah.
Which I don't think it actually is, but I think that their marketing has not done it service.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the marketing when it first came out, they were referencing things like Harry Potter, which I know nothing about, so it kind of put me off at first, but I've enjoyed it enough that I don't think it's that at all. I think they, like you said, kind of did a bad job marketing it as more of a kid's title, when it's really not. It's a kind of a very good all-age title, which is very hard to do. I support it wholeheartedly.
Cool. And Tia, what did you read this past week?
The standout for me this past week was definitely Mirror Number 1 by Emerius and Wei Lim, which, as I understand it, was originally part of the Eight House series that Image has been doing, which is, I guess, a series of sort of loosely connected stories where they take place in the same universe somehow, but they have different creators and very different casts of characters. And this one, I don't know why they chose to pull out on its own, but I'm really glad that they did. It's really beautiful. The layout kind of reminds me of Islamic architecture, and the art style is very like mosaic-like, where the color is laid down kind of like tesserae, and it's very painterly and gorgeous. Definitely a good book for people who are really into the art side of things. The story is pretty interesting too. It's about this mage, and he, as a young boy, is separated from his best friend, who is like a human dog hybrid with invisibility powers. And it's actually very important that she disappears, because they live in this war-torn world where people experiment on these animal hybrids and treat them very badly, which this mage, as he grows up in this world, feels very terrible about. So as an adult, he has this animal hybrid friend who's like a little lab rat girl, and I think she's going to help him out. I'm hoping that she's going to reunite him with his dog friend. That seemed to be the implication. So really sweet story. I think a lot of adventure and magic and cool stuff coming down the pipe. Definitely beautiful. Highly recommend.
This is getting like a Sweet Tooth / Avatar The Last Airbender vibe from me for some reason, with all these animal hybrid people, animals. But maybe that's just me.
Well, okay, so I read this week too. I picked it up solely based on the cover because it was gorgeous. And yes. So I definitely agree that the art is fantastic, but I found the lettering really jarring, which usually is a thing that if it's good, I don't notice it. You know what I mean? Like, it just kind of blends into
the lettering part of the ring. Is way too prosaic for the story, I think. Yeah.
It didn't fit the art at all. And no. It really, I don't know, it breaks the flow of the art for me and of the story itself.
Except for the weird cat.
Yeah. As I'm reading it, I'm like, didn't we just get a new book from Image with weird hybrid animals getting experimented on? Monstrous. You know?
Yeah. But, you know, Monstrous, I think, has a really strong feminist message. Like, it's not subtle. And it's very much about, I think, bodily autonomy coming from a sort of feminist perspective, whereas I think this one, if you're like looking to be really highbrow about it, I think it's more into issues of just like power dynamics in general and the ethics of like exerting power over things that don't have bodily autonomy in some way.
Yeah, I definitely agree that they're very different stories. But that was just my first, you know, knee-jerk reaction was, oh, this feels a little familiar. But
maybe they saw how popular Monstrous was and was like, this doesn't need to be a miniseries. Let's make it a whole thing.
Is Monstrous a miniseries?
No, but okay. Mirror was going to be just one of the stories in the Eight House series.
Oh, and I see what you're saying.
Now it's its own series. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, let's move on very quickly because we've got this great debate to get to. Let's talk about what we're excited for this upcoming week. So, Tia, let's go back to you. We'll do reverse order or something, or maybe if I can remember the order of people. But we'll start with you. What are you most excited for this week?
Cool. I'll keep it short and sweet. I'm really excited for Darth Vader, number 16. I think that Kieran Gillen is really killing it, making Darth Vader a really compelling central character without dulling down his like bad guy-ness too much. So I've been really loving this series, and I'm sure I will love this one too.
Cool. Kate, I'm just going to go in the order that I have it in my notes. I'm sorry. Kate, what are you excited for this week?
I am really excited for Snowblind number 3. I've talked about this comic before on the podcast. It is through Boom Studios. It's a 4-part miniseries with writer Ollie Masters and artist Tyler Jenkins, and it is an all watercolor rural noir crime piece set in Alaska following a teenager Teddy who, through an accidental sort of Facebook posting, has exposed his family. He found out that they're in witness protection, and through this posting of this photo of his father, he exposed their whereabouts, and lots and lots of twists and turns have ensued, and I'm not going to spoil any of it, but it is definitely building to a head at this point, and I am really excited for this issue.
Gotcha. I feel like every time you talk about this, I'm getting this book when it comes out in trade.
It's absolutely.
Sounds super cool.
It is so good. It's very cinematic.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And the watercolor, I've actually picked up, I think, number two when I was at the comic shop last time. And just looking at it, the art is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Absolutely gorgeous. Nick, what are you excited for this upcoming week?
Well, it's Batman 49. And I know, gee, Nick, Batman came out this week. Are you not going to pick it? No, I am going to pick it. But for different reasons than last time, because I can be articulate and nuanced, so suck it. Person who is intimidating me.
Prove your point. It's not you, Mike. Prove your point about how nuanced and articulate you can be.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing here is that what's really amazing about the Snyder-Capullo run is that it's actually had very, very few guest artists. And I'm not even including annuals and things like that on the main book itself. There have been so few guest artists, and that's not to take anything away from Capullo, but it's always really interesting when you get someone new. I think up to this point, we've only had three. I think it was Dustin Nguyen on the preview to Batman Eternal. I think it was Becky Cloonan. Paul, is that right? On the what's her face? It was the one centric with the girl who's an electrician whose name is completely... God damn it. Anyway... her, and then Matteo Scalera did one maybe about 10 issues back, and that's been it. And so this issue, we're actually going to get Yannick Paquette, mm-hmm. who, of course, worked with Snyder all the way through.
I know
through
that she Snyder's, wrote an issue. I don't know if she did the art.
Tenure on Swamp Thing during the New 52. Amazing artist. He does some amazing, amazing panel work. He did some really weird, twisted, tree-shaped, curving and twirling panels for Swamp Thing. I don't know if we're going to quite get the same with Batman, but... It's just always a treat to see someone new taking the reins, even if only for an issue or so. And maybe we're going to get to see a little bit of, well, I don't want to, we're getting to a point with Batman where we really, we can't discuss too much, so I'll leave it at that.
The first rule of Batman is don't talk about Batman.
No, exactly. Well, then I've, exactly. then I've broken that rule a lot.
Yeah.
Except for this show where Nick spoils it almost every week, him or Paul. It's one or the other.
Yeah.
Anyways, Paul, what was your pick? What's your pick for this week?
Believe it or not, my pick is not Batman number 49. Very nearly was, but then I remembered that Love and Rockets New Stories Volume 8 is due out this week. If you don't know, Love and Rockets is a pretty legendary underground comic from the 80s. It's been around for about 30 years now, and it features the work mm-hmm. of two brothers, Jaime and Gilbert Hernandez, each doing their own long ongoing story. So about 8 years ago, they turned from doing monthly comics to just doing these annual releases where every year you get a new, about 100 pages of comics from the two brothers. And it's interesting because Gilbert Hernandez is very prolific. He usually puts out sometimes two or three OGNs a year. And then in addition to this, he just wrote Twilight Children for Vertigo. So you see his stuff all the time. This is the only stuff I get from Jaime Hernandez, who is right up there, probably in my top two favorite comic book artists of all time. So anytime I get new stuff from him, I'm very excited.
Who's the other? Who's the other, by chance?
I'll give you two guesses.
If it's not obvious.
The initials JK. We'll see if you can get it from that. Love and Rockets, the Jaime Hernandez stories, he's been telling one long, ongoing sort of soap opera-type story since the 80s about this woman named Maggie Chiscareo. And we've seen her grow from being a teenager in the first stories to being, someone in her mid-40s now. And the last volume, Volume 7, saw Maggie reunite with her former best friend, former romantic interest, Hopi Glass. That pair of Maggie and Hopi was the basis of a lot of Jaime Hernandez's stories in the 80s and 90s. So to see them back together for the first time in the last volume was very exciting for me as a longtime fan. They've reunited to go to a reunion of all their punk rock friends in LA. So Volume 8, I cannot wait to see what Jaime Hernandez has in store for these characters that I love and know so dearly. So it's probably one of my favorite comics of all time. And it's kind of nice that it's like an annual yearly treat to get new stories from him, So, very excited.
That's exciting, man.
Very cool.
Having only read Maggie the Mechanic, I actually understood a little bit what you're talking about here.
I know.
So that's super cool.
It's very daunting. I mean, again, 30 years of like one long story. But man, once you get started, I've just mainlined those books. I mean, I could not put that stuff down. So highly, highly recommend checking out Love and Rockets. Even if it's just picking up this new volume, I'm sure there'll be something that'll grab you and you'll be inspired to go check out the rest of it.
Gotcha. Well, my pick for this week is Constantine the Hellblazer number 9, because this book is fantastic. James Tynion and Ming Doyle on writing, and Riley Rossimo apparently doing all the art. Who knows when you actually see the credits? A lot of the times it's like Riley Rossimo on layouts and someone else on finishes, but it still looks like Rossimo's art. This book is nonstop fantastic. We're getting into the more deep, dark, spooky magic side of things, and I love it. I can't say anything more than that. You've heard me talk about this on this podcast far too many times. This book is the best Constantine book you can read right now, because it's the only Constantine book right now, but that doesn't mean that it's not great. It is actually a very fantastic story, and if you're into someone being a smartass and also being a magic user who knows way too much and wants to tell you how much he knows, this book is the best. So, I don't know if that does it justice, but this book is, I cannot recommend it enough to everybody. And Riley Rossimo's art is beyond amazing. Like, every issue, I think, is, I could take any panel, any full page spread, and just put it on my wall and be proud of it. It's so good.
So you've talked about this a lot on the podcast, and I have been completely sold. And I just want to throw out there that volume 1 of the collected trade comes out, and I'm thinking I'm going to pick that up.
Yeah. Yes. Good. Then I've done my job. I've sold this to one person. That's all I need to hear. And see, the thing is, if you buy it, you're going to love it, and then you and I can just talk about it. It's so good. It's one of those rare comics from the big two that goes out way beyond your expectations, because you're like, oh, it's a big two book, but it's actually very, very well crafted, and it doesn't connect to anything. You don't need to know anything other than John Constantine is a badass. Like, that's it. And not like in a Bruce Willis, like, diehard action star badass. He's just the type of smarmy individual that you hate and love at the same time. And you watch him, like, make mistakes over and over and over, and yet you root for him. Despite him, you know him, he's going to make mistakes. So it's great. But we're gonna take a quick break. I know we're not supposed to do that anymore, but we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna do this whole great debate. So get excited. The topic is, and I'm going to say it after the break, but the topic is comic book restaging, why or why not? Get the full definition in just a moment. This is The Great Debate. The greatest debates of all debates. And quite honestly, the topic isn't maybe as exciting as I thought it was going to be months or weeks ago when Kate initially brought this up, but the topic is comic book restaging, why or why not? Now, the definition of comic book restaging is the idea that you could take a script that was written for a book at any time. For instance, and probably what we'll be referencing the most is going to be Alan Moore's Watchmen with art by Dave Gibbons. And taking that original script and taking a quote-unquote modern-day artist, or an artist that is popular now rather than back in the 80s, and having them redraw the entire comic panel to panel to, I guess, make the book more applicable to new, or more approachable for new readers. So, on one side of this argument, we have Tia and Kate, who are for this idea, and on the other side, we have Nick and Paul, who are against this idea. So, in between the segments here, we flipped a coin, and we decided the order of arguments, I guess, is going to be Tia, followed by Paul, followed by Nick, followed by Kate. Each person will get 5 minutes to make their opening statements. And after everyone has exhausted their 5 minutes, I will stop them. And following that, we'll be doing 15 minutes-ish of back and forth. I don't want to say 15 minutes, but it could be somewhere around there. And following that, each side will then get 10 minutes to wrap up their statements and give a final decision. And then we'll probably do some talking afterwards. So this should be a big, long, organized thing. And I think that's kind of timely given the, you know, election debates that are going on right now. Maybe that's just a coincidence. I don't know. So, since I think so everyone's topical. Ready and I've just said a lot of words, I hope everyone's excited for this. Please tell me if you're excited or not. I don't know.
But I am. We're excited. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I'm excited.
So the person that's going to be going first is Tia. So start in just a moment. I'll be giving you 5 minutes. I'll say go and you'll have 5 minutes, and then I will stop you I'll give you a 30-second warning at the end, and then I will stop you when you have exhausted your time. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. You have 5 minutes starting now.
All right. Well, I think that this is a really weird position for me to take, but because I'm an art historian by training, but I actually think that by arguing that it would be useful to have these comics restaged by new artists actually underscores how important art is to comics. And the first question I think that we need to ask ourselves is, on whose authority would these remakes be made? Are they fan-made or are they official remakes? In other words, whose interest does the remake serve and what is its intent? On the whole, comics leave out a lot of people in their representation of the world. And so this makes me question, why is the author and the artist and not the reader so sacrosanct here? If we can sort of veer off into the death of the author territory here, if we think of these things as more of a collaborative interpretation that takes the reader's perspective into account, what can we gain by that? And how can we broaden an audience or diversify a medium by doing this? And then this also brings up an important question of the text image hierarchy, which I don't actually think this really is, because comics as a medium don't have a straightforward relationship of text and image, because scripts are not meant for the audience to read. They're meant for an artist to read and then stage that world based on their interpretation. So while comic making is a collaboration between artist and writer, it's the writer who makes the story and the artist who stages it. So Shakespeare plays that get restaged, centuries after Shakespeare's there to have his hands all over it, doesn't mean that, you know, Shakespeare is invalid. Leonardo's Annunciation painting isn't canceled out, or the Bible tale itself isn't invalid if other artists paint the Annunciation. And so you really have to think about what exactly is the relationship between word and image. There's a scholar named W.J.T. Mitchell who says that this relationship never appears as a problem without being linked to questions of power, value, and human interest. So disrupting the natural order of things is actually a really useful thing to do if you're talking about canonical work, which obviously canon critique is really vital to any art form, including comics. It's so important. And if you think about artists like Yinka Shonabari or Kehinde Wiley, who take works that are really important to the Western art history canon and restage them with, for example, Ice-T as Napoleon Bonaparte, they help us understand why canonical work has obscured certain important cultural topics, where it has been helpful, where it has failed. These are important insights to keep the art form itself moving forward. So by restaging comics with new art, how can we shed new or different light on really important canonical works? What if Ozymandias was drawn as a woman? What if the Dark Knight was black? How would this change things in useful ways that further comics as a medium and allow comics, the canon of comics, to be a vehicle in understanding its own construction?
All right. Just under 5 minutes. Very well done.
I timed myself.
Very good. Very good. Well, okay. Let me finish writing some notes really quick.
I feel like we should just slow cap it out, man. That was solid.
Yeah.
Very well done. Yeah. So, Paul, if you're ready.
I am ready.
Cool. So let's start. We'll give you 5 minutes. Starting now.
Well, I think what's the issue here is the comment Kate made where she said she would be more interested in reading certain quote-unquote canonical comics if she enjoyed the art better, and that kind of raised several red flags for me. I think there's four issues at play here, and in theory, I'm not opposed to the idea of remaking or restaging comics. I think if you're talking about the mainstream big two comics, it's something that's always been done. We're always going to be retelling these origin stories of these characters, changing them with more contemporary storytelling techniques, more contemporary artwork. That's always going to be part of comics. My point is that in doing so, you're changing the story. Watchmen drawn by anyone other than Dave Gibbons is no longer Watchmen. It's something different, and that's perfectly fine, but to say that you've engaged with the story or read the same story with different art, I think is problematic. So the four issues I think that are at play here is, one, the issue of there being a comic book canon. I don't think that there is a strict comic book canon. I don't think Watchmen is a book that everyone needs to read in order to be, quote-unquote, a good comic book fan. There are a lot of things in Watchmen that are very interesting. What's most interesting about Watchmen, I think, is the way that the story is told. So the visual out, the layout of the pages, the visual storytelling, the narrative that's done visually on the page, that's what's really important about Watchmen. And I think that is the stuff that's been incorporated and used by artists ever since its publication. So like a canonical text, like, for example, The Odyssey by Homer, it's something that every one that's been doing comics since Watchmen has incorporated into their work. You don't necessarily have to have read The Odyssey to understand allusions to it. You don't necessarily have to read Watchmen to understand why it's important. That's one thing. So comic book canon is something I could definitely see critiquing. I don't think it's that important. The idea of retelling or adapting stories, like I already mentioned, that's fundamental to particularly mainstream superhero comics. How many times has Batman's origin been retold by different artists or different writers? Each retelling of that story, however, is a different story. It focuses on different elements of what makes the character interesting. For example, Detective Comics number 627, which was an anniversary issue celebrating 600 issues since Batman's appearance in Detective Comics, you get the original story from 1939, and then you get two retellings by different creative teams. Each retelling is radically different in the way it's told. Yes, it's the same story, but it's told in a different way, therefore making it a new experience, if you could put it that way. Another example would be Ultimate Spider-Man by Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Bagley. When they take six issues to tell this character's origin story, whereas Stan Lee and Steve Ditko did it in 11 pages back in 1961, you're talking about very different storytelling methods resulting in different stories, even though technically the details might be all the same. The larger issue that I have a problem with here is this idea that Kate's saying you could take the script with different art and have it be the same story. I don't think that's true, as I've already articulated here. Changing the art radically changes the story because artwork has a narrative impact on the story itself. Artwork has a narrative weight in comics. So, like I said, having someone else draw Watchmen technically could use the same script, even the same breakdowns on the page, but the different artwork, something other than Dave Gibbons' artwork, would make it a very different story because the artist would choose to highlight different things. Again, I don't think this is a bad idea. I'm certainly open to the idea that we could take classic comic books or classic stories and retell them. We just need to be aware that they would be very different stories because of the differences in art. I think this does imply a hierarchy here because you're saying the script is what's important. Alan Moore's script is what we're not going to change. The artwork is what we're going to change. I think, and I don't think this is what Kate intended, I'm not, you know, I think that there's an implication there that the artwork is somehow less important to the story in that sense, that anybody could interpret this script and have it be the same story. What I'm saying is you radically would be a different story because the artwork is different, because comics are a visual medium. So, this idea of artistic style in a comic book, I would say that redoing a comic, for example, Matt Madden's book, 99 Ways of Telling a Story, he does just this. He takes the same one-page comic book strip and then retells it in 99 different ways. Each one is radically different because the narrative aspect of the artwork. So I think remaking comics, even if we keep the script the same and just change the artwork, results in different stories. Again, I'm not going to say that's a bad thing, but I'm going to say that that's something we need to articulate and make sure that we're clear on. It is a different comic than the one that the original comic.
Cool. Just on time. Way to go, man. All right. So up next is Kate. You have 5 minutes starting now.
So I think the point that Paul brings up about it being a entirely different story is where the real disagreement here is in our approaches to this topic, because where he sees it as an entirely different and new story when you have a new artist, I definitely don't see it as that. I see it as more of a restaging, the same way that having a different play director or movie director with the same script makes it a reimagining versus an entirely new story. And I, as Tia explained, there's inherent value there in this reimagination, especially when you bring different viewpoints to it. So if we had Emma Rios or Valentine DeLandro doing art, you'd have much different viewpoints expressed than what we have in these classic books, which are almost entirely cisgender, heteronormative white males. And so that's where I think this could get really interesting. I also think that when you take these works that are real classics and restage them, you can draw in readers to then to the classics, because like everyone has said, you're not eliminating the original or detracting from its value. And in the same way that a movie remake, such as the Romeo and Juliet movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, increases interest in readership of the classic play, I think the same would be true for comics. Obviously, since this hasn't been done in this exact manner, we don't know, but I think it's a pretty safe bet. And also, when these works were produced, it was at a time when page and print quality was really different, and there was much more limited use of technology. So I feel like new art could be considered an entirely different medium as opposed to a redoing with the same things. So it's like taking a screenplay from the stage and then putting it to the screen complete with CGI. You're really building upon the original in a way that doesn't devalue or eliminate it, but really enhances it and brings something new and different. And this kind of thing, I know we don't like to talk about or think about the financial aspect of the industry, and it's very poo-pooed upon if, oh, so-and-so is a sellout or whatever. But really, regardless of the quality or value in the retelling, I think a ploy like this would be incredibly successful from a business standpoint, because even people who don't like it, everyone, you know, wants to rage on Reddit about it if they don't like it, so that means you have to pick it up and read it. And the media attention it could draw in a lot of new and old readers alike, maybe some people who read old stuff and have gotten out of it now. And the profits could then support new projects or add a cushion to give space for more diverse titles that right now might not have the financial viability to keep them going otherwise. I also think that classic comic art, while there's a lot of value, and like you were saying, it is intrinsic to the story. It's not, you can't really separate it out and say this is a separate thing from the writing. But we have to recognize that now we've come a long way in the last few decades with modern notions of social justice, and we've grown as a society to see where some of these things in classic comics are really problematic, with things like the apparel that women are in, or rather the lack thereof, with the really cliche racial characterizations, especially in regards to African-American characters. And again, with the all-white, you know, cisgender male creative teams. So I think it's important as a sort of, not retconning, but going back and kind of atoning for past mistakes. Now that we know better, let's go back and fix this. And in that, not say the past is bad, but say the past is problematic, and here is maybe something that is more appropriate for who we are today as a society and for today's readers. That's all I got.
Okay. That's fine. All right. So, Nick, you are up with your, I guess, the last statement of our first round of quote-unquote debates. So, Nick, you have 5 minutes starting now.
I would say one of the first things that comes to mind when this whole topic rolls around that I think no one else has really touched on yet is the whole legality, compensation, residual side of things, which, I mean, we can talk about, well, if you can, you know, put it into practice, what happens, but there's also the side of whether or not you can actually legally do this in the first place, and whether or not creators are going to claim that they have a hold to things, especially because in comics, much unlike maybe, you know, a painting by Leonardo da Vinci or some ancient sculpture, a lot of these people are actually still alive in this day and age, and so a lot of these people can start to lay claim to these things, or the question of authorial intent, well, there really isn't one anymore. You can go ask the person. I mean, I think in that one famous interaction with Ray Bradbury, someone actually asked him what the point of his book was, and he told them, or rather the student told him what he thought about it, and Bradbury told him he was wrong, and then, of course, the student completely dismissed it, and that's another varied criticism thing. But yeah, from a legality standpoint, there are issues. Then there's the question of compensation. Who's going to get paid what? Is the new artist going to get paid more than the writer who wrote it way back when? How are you going to dole out the money for that? Are you going to actually pay the original art team that did the original work in the first place, that made it famous enough or you know, notable enough that it needs to be dealt with or reissued again now? So there are issues with that. I do also obviously have issues with authorial intent. And I do believe that a script is something that is not something that can be easily extracted or dissected from the whole collaboration of colors, inks, scripting, writing, pencils, inking, etc., etc. I don't believe it can be so neatly lifted out of the equation. If you've read or looked at a lot of scripts, many of which are written with a specific artist in mind, who obviously most of them are, but there are notes in the margins for the artist, or, you know, they'll note something along the lines of, you know, I'm having you draw this issue because I think you bring out this part of things better, or you do this thing better. Scott Snyder has talked about frequently all the time how he picks different pencilers to do different things. And so there's a level of intent there, even a level of intent by DC in picking the teams that get paired up together and the editors at DC. And that intent immediately dissolves the moment you extract the script or attempt to extract the script and say, well, we can just pull this out and throw it on someone else's doorstep and hope that they'll do the job. When a lot of the time that script is not written for them, it's not meant for them. That art, that, you know, themes or the issues in that script may or may not even be, you know, relevant to them. That doesn't say they won't find someone who's somewhat up to bat for doing it, but there's a disservice there. And I think that is a major problem, especially if you look at something like, for example, Frank Miller, who, don't get me wrong, I don't love Frank Miller. There's no love lost there. But with a lot of his works, especially his Dark Knight stuff, you've got him writing and drawing it. And what if they say, well, gee, Frank, we like your script, even though maybe I don't. But we really think your art is just kind of unappealing. It's sort of loose. It's kind of rough. We'd like to keep one side of your, you know, you poured yourself into this work and it's a singular thing by you, and we'd like to sort of slice your contributions and go find someone else. And I think that's also very problematic, and it raises the question again of how do you decide if and how and when you're going to do these things when a lot of these people are still alive and may or may not hold a claim to these things, and I have an issue with that as well. As for drawing things in a way that maybe presents more positive body image or reduces issues with stereotyping or people that are often misrepresented, I have no problem with people doing their own work in a way that sort of rights that wrong, or, you know, creating something that's sort of their own story that responds to that. But I think just simply reusing the script and using the same title again, it sort of almost eliminates the original work. And that original work needs to stick around. It needs to be prominent, warts and all. It needs to be ugly and awful, because people need to be able to look at that and not say, well, we've got the nicer, cleaner replacement now. People need to be able to see the first one up front and visible and say, well, this thing is awful and it's bad, but we need to see it in that fashion and not just experience it secondhand from other people's, you know, words.
Cool. Just under 5 minutes. So we're going to take a quick break so we can basically, I can put some notes together, and when we come back, we're going to do some back and forth questions. So we'll be back in just a minute. So we're back for the back and forth portion of this great debate that I'm still very, very excited for. And I feel like tempers are rising, but that's okay. That's what we wanted here. No, we're all here for a good time. I don't think anyone's going to hate each other after the end of this. So at least that's what I hope. I just want us all to be friends, and I just, you know. No. Anyways, so we'll keep going, and I think what we're going to do for this next bit is we're going to have a bit of back and forth. And the first thing I actually want to ask both sides of this argument is I want to get the definition of what we're calling restaging that I know I vaguely described at the beginning of this discussion, but I want to see where the differing opinions lie, just for clarification for everyone, because I think there is a rift between both sides on what the definition is, and just to clarify for the audience, for everyone who's listening, where each side stands with that. So to get things started, I'm actually going to ask Kate and Tia if they want to start with their definition, then we'll move over to Nick and Paul's definition.
Yeah, I mean, I think our definition is pretty simple. We're just talking about taking an artist's script and handing it to, or sorry, taking a writer's script, handing it to an artist and have them illustrate it and using all of the description and directions and notes that are in the original script and see what they come up with that's different from the original artwork.
Okay. And Kate, Paul and Nick.
Yeah, that is...
Oh, I'm sorry, Kate.
No, that's fine. He was spot on. That is what I'm interpreting it as well.
Okay, and Paul and Nick.
I think that's... We're talking about the same thing, actually. I think when Kate made her point a few issues back on the podcast, she made this point where you could take the script and leave the page layouts the same and just replace the art. That's kind of what I have a contention with. I think this could be a fruitful exercise to remake scripts with different artists. My point is that it would just be a completely different comic. It would be a different story.
Nick, are you on the same page as that?
Yeah, he's got it. I think it's not so much a question of what it means, but whether or not you should do it. Yeah.
So we're back.
And we're back to square one. Okay.
Yeah, and that's where Tia and I are going. It'd be more of a reimagining of the same story versus a completely new one.
Because, I mean, if you hand the script to a new artist, then they're going to bring out different things from the script. I mean, I guess it's changing the story in a way, but they're not adding new things to the script that weren't there. Why didn't the first artist bring those things out?
Mm-hmm. Because then it also gets tricky depending upon whether or not there was any sort of collaboration in the writing of the script, which, of course, now is gone, perceivably.
Go ahead, Paul.
And back and forth between the artist and the writer, because that's gone now. You're not going to get that.
Well, I'm just saying this makes a distinction between the story and the artwork. And I think when you're talking about comics, you can't make that distinction because it's a visual medium.
So, not as much anymore, yeah.
Sorry, Paul. An artist redoing a script is going to be a different comic book than a different artist doing the same script. It's going to be fundamentally different because the visual nature of the medium.
Mm-hmm. I guess I don't see what the problem with that is necessarily, because the useful intellectual work that I think Kate and I are advocating for is actually in that difference.
And I'm not going to say that this isn't something that shouldn't be done. I'm just saying that needs to be clarified. The idea that you could, again, have someone else other than Dave Gibbons draw Watchmen and read it, I'm going to say you're reading a completely different story. I'm not saying it shouldn't be done or it wouldn't be an interesting academic exercise. I'm just saying it would be a completely different comic.
And it needs to stand apart and distinctively stand apart, you know, as being something separate, very separate.
But it's related, and the relationship is really important because the comparison is where you get into the contributions that Watchmen made and also that it could have made but didn't for various reasons that are very important and interesting.
Yeah, the later becomes a critique in a way of the former. And that relationship
But the danger is that, sorry.
The relationship is important there, so it's not a completely standalone. I think the fear that keeps kind of creeping into this for Paul and Nick, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that people will take the reimagined edition, if you will, and substitute it for the original and have it in a way replace it. And I don't think that is what would happen. And I think if you look at other mediums where this has been done, like in movie remakes and stuff like that, where the remake actually draws more attention and brings in new viewers to the original.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily have that fear of it replacing the original, because like you said, in other mediums, that's not the case. No one's going to confuse or assume that the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre doesn't exist anymore because they remade it, you know? Like, they stand on their own, and they're very different. They're both interpretations of the same story. My point, again, is that the role of the artist, I think, is being diminished in this argument, and I just think that if you're going to remake a comic, it's going to end up being very different. Again, maybe a worthwhile academic exercise, but to say that you've read Watchmen, if it's drawn by someone other than Dave Gibbons, I think that's the problem. He's as much of an author of the text as Alan Moore. So to replace him would be a completely different story.
I am not sure that I agree with that, actually, because he is the interpreter of the script. So he is presenting the public face of Alan Moore's ideas. And so he is the author of his artwork based on those ideas.
I just have to believe that it's more collaborative than that. I have to believe mm-hmm. that the script cannot be that sacrosanct of a text that it can be just interpreted differently and be the same story.
Being a different story is kind of the point, though.
Yeah, I don't think it is the same story. Okay. I think it's an evolution okay. of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
But if your point is that you would want to, you would be more interested in these texts, these quote-unquote canonical texts. And again, I think we're all on the same page that the idea of the comic book canon is problematic to begin with. But the idea that these books that have a...
Sorry.
You don't think...
Paul, continue your first point, and we'll get to sure, that sure. in a moment.
So I'm what I'm saying is that you would be more interested in reading these historically important texts, let's put it that way, if they were more visually appealing. What I'm saying is that changing the artwork changes the text. You would not be reading the same text. It'd be something completely different.
Yeah, and I think you're drawing to the point where I, in that podcast, was talking specifically about some parts of the Sandman series that have some yeah. seriously dated and degraded art that yeah. I feel in my experience with getting others to try and read the book, because I really, really like the story, but it can be a real hindrance to getting into it. And I think you're right, where it becomes something different, and to equate it is like the saying that you love Harry Potter but haven't read the books, and then all the people who have read it are like, oh, it's not the same. Seeing the movies is not the right. same. Yeah. And I think that's yeah. kind of right, the same right. feeling that Paul's experiencing here, is where if you have this more, I guess, approachable reformatting, or you know, making the art more updated, it can mm-hmm. it changes it. And to say that, then you yeah, I get what you're saying. I guess I can agree with and see that point, that for mm-hmm. issues like that where it's not changing, it is only changing to be more visually appealing to this generation mm-hmm. in terms of color quality and image being more dynamic, then yeah, I can see where that would be. Probably that's like turning a movie from black and white into color, and then being like, "I watched the same classic." And I'm like, "No, Cheaper by the Dozen right. is not the same with Steve Martin." So,
yeah.
So Tia, back to your point about canon, you were bringing up a point that you think that is still important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's disingenuous to claim that there is no canon, or that the canon isn't impactful in comics today.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly why it's so important to have a really close eye on it and to critique it. And a really useful way is to reimagine it through modern lens visually, and it can really draw out some of the ways that the canon has been limited, or it can highlight things that were there that were not important to people at the time, but that mm. are now, because comics is becoming more diverse. And and so I think that identifying canonical works and thinking about how they might look different with a new set of eyes coming from a modern perspective, that perhaps does make a new work, but the comparison between that and the old is like I said, that's where a lot of the intellectual work happens.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think a really common kind of critique of this kind of reimagining is, you hear, especially when I'm on the web forums, you hear a lot of people saying, well, why don't, if you have a problem with this, or you want to see more diversity, why don't you make a new title? Just, you know, disregard the canon and make a new thing that has the things you want to incorporate. And I think the big issue with that is that comics, in a very strong way, have become our society and America's version of folktales and legends. And they are very tied to our society. Even if you don't read comics, you know who Superman is, and Batman, and Wonder Woman, and there's allusions to them and lots of literary and screen works. And so it is an important thing to then bring more people into, and more representations into that canon, because it is a part of our culture that you can't just you know, make your own. And it is important to also make new titles, obviously, but doing so evolves our society's mythos in a potentially positive way that it also is more reflective of our society as America becomes itself more diverse and more accepting, if you will. Although, obviously, as we're seeing right now with our politics, there's a pretty strong backlash. And I think that's reflected in the comic community as well, as you get the kickers and screamers on Reddit going, no, 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 I don't want a female Thor. This is awful. Get your own series.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can totally see that point. I mean, as a straight white male in his mid-30s, 99% of, like, pop culture is made for me. So it's sometimes it's important to see from other perspectives. And someone who's a big fan of both comics and pro wrestling, I have to juggle with the fact that both of those art forms I love are rife with racism and sexism in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, there's important work to be done to correct that. And I think it's happening in both of those things. I think what's interesting, again, we're seeing stories being retold all the time. Comic book stories are retold all the time. I think the real contention here is the idea of what's being retold. Is it a reimagining of a story, or is it just swapping out outdated art for something new and shiny? That's what I have the problem with here.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm all for adding the CGI to, you know, remaking the Star Wars.
Well, I knew someone was going to bring that up.
You know, again, the illusion I made maybe off mic earlier when we were talking about this was the difference between taking Shakespeare's script and remaking it in different time periods to retell the story and reformat it. That's really interesting. Where compare that to taking Hitchcock's Psycho and Gus Van Sant's remake, where he just remade it shot for shot in color. That doesn't seem to have much academic value, as opposed to retelling it in a different time period or with different, you know, characters.
I feel like you're contradicting yourself here.
I have to ask the question here. Let me interject and say, are we talking? It seems like we're gearing more towards the idea of reimagining versus complete remakes, where a remake is something that has the original story in mind, but is completely, like, restructured from the ground up, but it still gets the main point across. Like, retelling...
Right, such as this would be West Side Story, essentially.
Yes.
Okay, but you can't simultaneously argue that the art and the writing has this important collaboration, and and that...
Well, not always.
And that the art, well, you can't simultaneously say that if I handed a script to a new artist, they had them redo it exactly as the script says, that isn't a collaboration, and the primacy of the artist here is being compromised if we do that, because we're not asking anyone to do it shot for shot but in color. We're handing them the script, and maybe it says do a 6-panel layout, and in this panel it says this, and in this panel it says this, but we need to trust that the new artist is going to think of an interesting way to do it that is not a shot for shot, but in fact their own interpretation.
Okay, I mean, maybe this is just a confusion between, I thought that was the original point Kate made, was that you could keep the exact same page layouts and breakdowns and just change the art. It's almost like recoloring it in a way, and I would even argue that a recolored comic is a different reading experience than the original. So,
if someone asked me and you to make a 6-page layout, grid layout, and told a story, you know, explained what each panel would say, I have a feeling they would look really, really different, because you and I have very different worldviews and really different training and really different background. So, I guess I don't understand why you guys are like taking it so literally that it would just be like the exact same designs, the exact same composition.
Well, that was sort of the original argument.
I think I specifically even said that I love the layouts of Sandman and wanted those the same, that I just wanted the art in it to be different, but and then it's kind of evolved into this thing that has been more than the sideways comment. Then Twitter happened.
So with a lot of that, okay, so let me ask one more question, I guess, since we have about 3 minutes. The one final thing I was thinking of was, so are we approaching this now from a commercial success, or trying to sell this to more people, trying to get this more out in the world, or are we coming at this from an intellectual, like, we want to try this, not to say we personally want to try this, but that this would be a good experiment in trying to get a story that is worth everyone reading out there, or are we just trying to sell more books?
I'd say both.
I guess.
Both, absolutely. Because without something being financially viable, you can only, your moral high horse doesn't go very far when it doesn't have any fuel. You know what I'm saying? So I think they're intrinsically tied, even if we don't want them to be. If something mm-hmm. isn't making money, it's not going to keep being published. It's not going to keep being stocked. It's not going to keep being sold. So you need something to both be financially viable and to be an important contribution. In order for it to be an important contribution, the best, you know, most profound documentary doesn't have a societal impact if it's not a commercial success. Blackfish wouldn't have the ramifications it does today on, you know, our SeaWorld and the thoughts of the country in regards to how orcas are treated if it hadn't been so good that people went and saw it and went and told their friends and shared it and all that stuff. So I think it is very much both.
But that also begs the question then, does a story outweigh its presentation? You know, where is the level of, is the story so appealing, so interesting, so well told that even if it doesn't look great or doesn't, like, I guess if the art or the visual aspects aren't that great, is the story, like, greater than the, I guess, visual, the way that it's told visually? And I realize that's again, putting...
Are you asking, can it compel you to continue, obviously, reading something that you would otherwise find aesthetically unappealing?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And I think it works the other way, too, where I've talked about reading Elektra solely based on the art. I think there's some comics are really solid in both regards, and some comics are what much better writing than art, and vice versa. Sometimes the art is what keeps you coming back, and the writing's very ho-hum. So I think the work we're talking about redoing is the work that is amazing writing.
Interesting, because I find if I don't like the artwork of a comic, I can't keep reading it. I'm almost purely visual, so...
I definitely have series I love that I just like.
For me, there's
like
a line, and it does reach a point, but, I mean, I'll compromise to a certain extent.
I feel like I'm coming at this from a much more academic standpoint, because for me, it's not even about the quality of the art. I mean, we can bring up an example of a book with art that I really love, and I would still advocate for seeing what another artist would do with the script, because I think that it's useful to see important stories, you know, brought to life in different ways. It only serves to enhance the story. It only serves to enhance the existing world that comic lives in. So I feel like I'm not qualifying my advocation of new artists.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's not how this originally started. It originally started as a mini vent about not being a huge fan of Sandman art, but I definitely agree that even things like Watchmen that have good yeah. art, there would be a lot of value in seeing what someone else, especially someone else that has a different worldview, like I was saying, Emma Rios, who's Spanish, or a female, or Valentine DeLando, who's an amazing artist but African-American, like that would have add value to the interpretation.
All right. Well, we're going to take another quick break, and we come back, we're going to get some closing statements from both sides of this argument. So we'll be back in just a moment. So for our closing remarks for this great debate that I keep calling the great debate because it's so exciting to me, we have chosen, in the break, we have chosen which side is going to go first. So Paul and Nick will be giving their closing statements first, followed by Tia and Kate. So Paul, you have time to give your closing debates. Keep it under 10 minutes, please.
Sure. First off, I just want to say how much I've enjoyed this debate. It raises issues that I find very interesting and fundamentally important to the medium of comic books. This idea of art and story coming together. And I think really the point here that I'm trying to make is that you can't separate the two. And there might have been some misunderstanding about the actual topic of the debate or the details of it, but from what I understand, the original notion Kate brings up, and the one that I took contention to on Twitter, was that you could take a comic book and save the page layouts, the words, the dialogue boxes, the dialogue itself, and simply swap out the art and have a new comic. The same reading experience, or one that's more visually appealing. My point is that in doing so, you, whether you intend to or not, devalue the role of the artist in making of the comic book. So when we read a canonical text or just a monthly book that we happen to read that we don't ascribe that sort of level of importance to, in both instances, the artist and the visual appeal of the book is what I think is fundamental to the story. And changing that in any way could be a very valuable academic exercise. And I think there's a lot of value to this idea of remaking comics or having different artists try out different same stories. But my point is that in doing so, you're fundamentally changing the story itself. It's no longer going to be the same story with a new coat of paint on it or a fresh recoloring. What it's going to be is a completely different reading experience, therefore making the narrative itself fundamentally different. I agree that there is a lot of value in this idea of retelling stories, and I would suggest that comics does that all the time. We retell the origin stories of our favorite characters, there's different interpretations of old stories. That's something that's very valuable and vital to the art form itself. And creating new stories, or creating new interpretations of old stories that are more inclusive, I think that's incredibly valuable. I'm just suggesting that changing the artwork in itself fundamentally changes the comic. It's no longer the same story if it's drawn by someone else. That's my closing statement.
And Kate and Tia, your closing statements.
So I think we would also like to acknowledge that this has been a really wonderful discussion that has brought up some really important things to think about. And one of the key, I think, points of contention between the two of us is this idea of the interplay between authorial intent and the role of a more collaborative interpretation of the text. Basically, at what point does the authorial intent cease having control over the way the text lives in the world? And for me and Kate, what we're saying about that is, you know, yes, there is a canon. And yes, the creators of these works and their collaboration is all really important to the canon, and that's part of why they're there. But by restaging these works, we're giving outsiders who weren't included at those points in time a chance to have a relationship with these works. So no, we're not making the same stories. And that's kind of the point. The interplay between the original and the restaging is really where a lot of the value is. And it's interesting to us that this is kind of drawn along gender lines. And I think that it's not necessarily on purpose, but, you know, women, minorities, queer folks, you know, we've wanted to have a relationship with comics the entire time, even when we haven't been represented. And I think that visual exclusion, that's a really important reason why I think we're open to this idea of making new restagings. And I also wanted to close by addressing this idea that by redoing the artwork, we're devaluing the artist. I think on the contrary, we're saying that the artwork is really articulate and it's really important. So it's basically so important that it's the part that is transformative. And so it's sort of maybe a different side of the coin here. And yeah, Kate, do you want to add anything?
No, that's absolutely right. I agree with what you said, and I'm also really glad that we've been able to have this discussion, and I want to thank Mike for giving us the platform to do it on. It's been a real treat.
Well, I'm very happy to provide that platform. This has been, like, the coolest thing for me. So I think that wraps up the debate and everything, but did any of you have any final comments, thoughts, things that you wanted to discuss that weren't necessarily included today, or, you know, just to say that you had a good time? I don't know if you had a good time or a bad time, but, you know.
Yes, Kate and I also wanted to say Tilda Swinton, Snowpiercer, mic drop.
Boom!
Because we were just talking about it.
Okay. Well, I think that about wraps things up for the episode. So thank you all for listening. And I'm going to do, we do normally don't do a sign off and or anything like that for the show, but I want to say that next week we're going to try to do this new thing where we give you a little bit of information about what we're going to be talking about next week. And next week we're going to be talking with Paul and Jeff about comic creators and social media and the expectations and social media interactions that we kind of had a couple episodes back, but we're going to further expand upon that topic. So tune in next week and it should be a fantastic time.
What are your thoughts on reimagining comics? Join our conversation by sending us email at cyborg@destroythecybe.org or find us on Twitter at @destroythecybe, as well as on each of our personal accounts there, which we'll post in the show notes. You can also find us on Tumblr at @destroythecyborg, as well as on Reddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by myself, Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Atmosphere and Infinity Shred. You can find Atmosphere on Bandcamp at atmosphere.bandcamp.com or through their Minneapolis-based label, Rhymesayers, at rhymesayers.bandcamp.com. You can find more of Infinity Shred, whose music we use for our opener and credits segment, at infinityshred.bandcamp.com and also at infinityshred.com. Check them out. They're definitely one of my favorites. If you love the show as much as we do, shout it from the rooftops, or don't. Maybe tell someone about the podcast, rate us online, or write to us. We'd love to hear from you. And again, thank you for listening.
I can't believe Paul hasn't read Harry. I can't believe Paul hasn't read Harry Potter.
Okay, so what year did Harry Potter come out? Like, when was the first book?
I think it was like 97.
Yeah.
Okay, I was already...
Also, Mike, sorry about that alarm thing. My phone glitched. I could not get that thing. It was on vibrate, and somehow my timer for timing the segments overwrote it.
Oh, that's all right. No, I just muted you because I heard Tia hesitate for a moment, and I was like, all right, this isn't going to happen anymore.
So, sorry. I dashed off into the other room to bury it underneath like a bunch of pillows. It was really amusing because I couldn't get it to stop making noise. And then as I told it to shut down, it was beeping all the way until the phone completely went off. I don't even... fucking hell. Good God, sorry. That wasn't, you know, like psychological warfare or anything. Okay. I mean, it was more of technological warfare between me and my fucking phone, so sorry.
Quote unquote accidents.
Yeah.